Hi, we're back again to take care of some questions that have been raised by the class relative to the discussion which you've had concerning the book of Revelation, and maybe concerning some things that were not discussed, about which there are some questions. The first question has to deal with Domitian, who was the emperor at the close of the first century. I believe his last year was 96 A.D., and he reigned over the Empire of Rome from 81 to 96 A.D., about 15 years. And oftentimes, when the advocates of the late date are interpreting the book, they interpret it in light of Domitian. And the question, of course, arises out of the fact that I have written a little article, a little pamphlet, that is entitled The Domitian Persecution. And with your patience for just a few moments, I'm going to read you from this track, and then it'll be apparent rather quickly why the question is asked. The little pamphlet is entitled The Domitian Persecution, with question marks all around it. And the first part of the little pamphlet suggests the persecution is undocumented. And we're going to be quoting now from this little pamphlet. In his most popular Bible handbook, Henry H. Halley wrote, Domitian instituted a persecution against Christians on the charge of atheism, that is, perhaps, refusal to participate in emperor worship. It was short but extremely violent. Many thousands were slain in Rome and Italy, among them Flavius Clemens, the cousin of the emperor, and his wife, Flavia Domitilla, banished, end quote. Halley made this statement without giving historical documentation. He's not alone in failing to document statements about a Domitian persecution. William Barclay wrote of Domitian, quote, he was a devil. He was the worst of all things, a cold-blooded persecutor, end quote. This quotation is found in the Revelation of John, volume 1, page 19 of his book. He gave no historical source for his statement. Many brethren have quoted Barclay, contending that the main reason for assigning the apocalypse to John, the apocalypse of John to the Domitian era, is because of the widespread persecution against Christians during his reign. It is usually argued that the Neronian persecution was confined to Rome, while the Domitian persecution was empire-wide. Documentation for such assertions is always other commentators on Revelation rather than historical sources. Wild undocumented statements of this nature by Revelation commentators are abundant. Ray Summers in Worthy is the Lamb wrote, and we quote, Domitian, parentheses, C, 81 to 96, close parentheses, is the emperor who has gone down in history as the one who bathed the empire in the blood of Christians, on page 83. If there was historical evidence of this persecution, surely Summers could have documented it. But he did not. Summers is often quoted by brethren who seek to establish that the persecution of Domitian was the persecution of Domitian's reign. But again, the only documentation for such claims are other Revelation commentators. In an article carried in The Bible Way, Jasper, Alabama, March-April 1983, under the heading of The Beast of Revelation in the Light of Prophecy, Fulfillment and History, Ken Butterworth and John Shaver, speaking of Domitian, said, quote, but there was no persecution before or after to compare to that of his reign. Nero's persecution was confined mainly to Rome, while Domitian's persecution was expanded to the whole of Asia Minor, end quote. It's on page 4. This statement was without any documentation at all. Now, why did they not document it? Why did these men write so boldly of a Domitian persecution and fail to substantiate it by historical documentation? There are two reasons why we would not document a claim. First, the matter is accepted as historical fact and needs no verification. Or, second, there is no evidence by which to document the claim. Into which category does the supposed Domitian persecution fall? Is it historically established as fact and needs no proof? Or is it assumed and commands no historical proof? It has been my opinion through the years that the Domitian persecution was established by sound historical evidence and needed no documentation. In fact, in my commentary on Revelation, the avenging of the apostles and prophets, I wrote of Domitian. It was during his reign that the second great Roman persecution was inflicted against Christians in 95 and 96 A.D., end quote, page 80. I did not document the statement because I believe the Domitian persecution was established historical record. In this respect, I'm sure I use the same license as the aforementioned writers. I do not accuse them of purposely misrepresenting the facts. None of us, I'm sure, would purposely relate a thing as true knowing it to be false. Though all of us at times have learned that we related things as true which eventually we learned were false. This appears to be the case regarding the oft-proclaimed Domitian persecution. Several months ago, I read John A.T. Robinson's Redating the New Testament. Robinson stated at least three times that he was not sure there was a Domitian persecution. My first reaction was, he must be mistaken. But he's a scholar of great reputation and background. He should be taken seriously. Investigation has proved him correct. There is no historical evidence that would prove Domitian was responsible for the death of a single Christian, much less that he slew many thousands bathing the empire in their blood. No historian current with Domitian's reign records any evidence of Christians being persecuted, though they did record the Neronian and Trajan persecutions. The evidence tends to suggest that the Domitian persecution is the creation of church writers late in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. Edward Gibbon, in his famed work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, in discussing the Domitian persecution said, quote, "But this persecution, parentheses, if it deserves that epitaph, close parentheses, was of no long duration," end quote, page 278. Gibbon, while expressing his belief that Flavius Clemens and Domitilla, among others, were punished as Christians, admitted that he was not sure this brief conflict deserved the right to be called a persecution. James Moffat, in Volume 5 of the Expositor's Greek Testament, while admitting no literary record of the Domitian persecution exists, argues that a persecution did take place upon the premise that Pliny's letter to Trajan indicated an earlier policy of the empire toward Christianity, on page 311. And we stop to make the observation that Pliny wrote this letter about 111 or 112 A.D. Now, his deduction, however, is not a necessary one and actually assumes the thing to be proven. The case for a Domitian persecution has been built upon very, very weak circumstantial evidence, which, considered within its context, neither demands nor implies a Domitian persecution. Is it not strange that neither Tacitus nor Suetonius, who reported the persecutions of Nero and Trajan's reigns, reported any sign of persecution under Domitian? This is especially significant since Suetonius, in reporting the persecutions of Christians under Nero, showed contempt for Christians. Would not a persecution under Domitian afford him opportunity to further show contempt? The earliest historical record of a persecution under Domitian by either church or secular historian is 75 years after the fact. In order to date the record that soon after Domitian's reign, we must give credibility to Milito and Hegesippus, the two sources cited by Eusebius in his Ecclesiastical History. Using these two men as sources, Eusebius, who wrote from 264 to 340 A.D., said of Domitian, quote, "He was the second that raised a persecution against us," end quote. He said that at least 200 years after the reign of Domitian. While Eusebius speaks of martyrdoms during the reign of Domitian, he does not cite a single case of a Christian dying as a result of such a persecution. This is rather remarkable since Origen, 185 to 254 A.D., relates that only a few whose number could be easily enumerated had died for the sake of Christianity up to his time. He said this a good 50 years or more before Eusebius recorded his history. Surely, if their number could be easily enumerated, Eusebius could have found one Christian who died for the cause of Christ during the reign of Domitian. He did not name one, which leads us to conclude that it is only by the twist of men's imagination that it can be said that many thousands of Christians were slain and the empire bathed in their blood during Domitian's reign. Primary history just does not teach it. If history does not teach the bloody Domitian persecution, where did honorable men get the impression there was one? Leanne Hardy Canfield, we want to get his name correct, in his work, The Early Persecutions of the Christians, said, quote, "The chief reason for making 96 the terminus ad quem is to make it coincide with the persecutions of the persecution of Domitian," end quote. He then adds, quote, "If it," parentheses, the book of Revelation, end quote, "does refer to conditions in Asia Minor under Domitian, it is the only source for such a persecution," page 162. Early church writers, when tracing the persecutions of the second century back to their beginning, were prone to interpret the scanty circumstantial evidence available as indicating persecution of Christians during the latter years of Domitian's reign. But even if we give them benefit of doubt concerning the evidence upon which they had built their case, it still would not prove Domitian was responsible for the death of any Christians. In fact, if there was a persecution at all, it was very, very mild. The historical record will show that the further away from the reign of Domitian you come, the worse the supposed persecution is portrayed. Jim McGiggin evidently discovered these facts, as any careful student of history will find, said, quote, "Although I think the personal involvement of Domitian in persecution has been overstated, he certainly did persecute them," end quote. This is from the book of Daniel by McGiggin on page 109. In my estimation, McGiggin then overstated the case by making Domitian the little horn of Daniel 7. The case has been more than overstated. It has been imagined and created in the minds of men. Unless there is evidence, friends, to support a bloody Domitian persecution, which none of the many historical sources that I've checked reveal, then the affirmation of a persecution during the reign of Domitian is the affirmation of an untruth. In times past, and even in the commentary, I have been guilty of teaching this untruth. But I'm not going to teach it in the future, simply because of the fact that there is no evidence that Domitian was a persecution. Now, the question really centers around this. Is there any evidence that Domitian was a persecutor? There is absolutely no literary, historical evidence that would convict Domitian of even looking cross-eyed at a Christian, much less that he was responsible for the death of many thousands of them and bathed the empire in their blood. The fact is that the evidence that has been supported to support a Domitian persecution is circumstantial evidence. Evidence which is subject to dual interpretation. If Domitian was a persecutor, it is certainly not proven by substantial evidence. It is not proved by evidence that would be considered as hard evidence. It would only be by circumstantial evidence. And if he was a persecutor, even the circumstantial evidence would only present him as being a very mild persecutor, and the persecution for the most part would have been in Rome and certainly not throughout the Roman Empire. When it comes to a comparison between the persecution of Nero and the persecution of Domitian, there's all kinds of evidence that Nero persecuted Christians and severely in the city of Rome. But there is absolutely no evidence of a literary nature from Domitian's time that would prove that he persecuted any Christians. So that's the case. Now, in the course of our discussions on the book of Revelation, I did not mention this. And the reason I didn't mention it is because of the fact that whether Domitian persecuted Christians or not has absolutely nothing to do with the book of Revelation. That is, from the standpoint of the primary substance of the book, It has absolutely nothing to do with it. It matters not to me whether he was a persecutor or wasn't a persecutor. But it does matter to those who hold to the late date. They have to have Domitian in the position of a persecutor to substantiate and to affirm their doctrine. Now, in times past, they've been able to get by without having to substantiate that. All they've had to do is simply to assert it. That's the reason why none of them ever tried to document it. But from now on, this individual, at least, is serving notice that when that argument is made, as far as this student is concerned, and I ask that the rest of you do it too, and that is to challenge those who affirm it to prove it. And if it's so, then we'll base the case upon the proof. But if it isn't so, let's quit teaching something that isn't true. Let's quit basing a position on the book of Revelation on something that cannot be proved. And if we'll do that, I think we'll come a long way toward a better understanding of the book of Revelation. Now, the second question that I have been asked to deal with centers around Revelation 15 and verse 8. In this text, as we covered it, evidently we had not made it abundantly clear as to what the point was in the text. Now I'll read these verses and then we'll give some attention to what is said. And one of the four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of the wrath of God, who liveth forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. And no man was able to enter into the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were filled. What we had seen in the 15th chapter of the book of Revelation were seven angels which made their appearance, and these, having the seven last plagues, received the seven bowls of wrath to pour out these plagues upon the ones for whom they are designated. But the particular point that is not evidently was not made clear was the point concerning the temple being filled with smoke and the fact that no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. I believe we pointed out in that study that the throne of God orders and directs this part of the apocalypse, because these come out from the altar. And as soon as the distribution is made, the temple then is filled with the smoke from the glory of God. And we suggested the comparison to the time when Moses finished the building of the tabernacle, at which time God manifested his presence and glory by a cloud to cover the tent of the congregation, and no man at that time could enter therein too. That's in Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 through 38. When Solomon finished the temple, God again manifested his presence and glory by a cloud that filled the house, and the priest could not stand to minister at that particular time. So that's found in 2 Chronicles 5, 11 through 14, and 1 Kings 8, 10 and 11. Now, in this scene, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven has been opened. It is finished, the same thing occurs this time. That is, it is filled with smoke. This time the cloud is not the cloud of moisture, but is a cloud of smoke. And this perhaps indicates the nature, the manifestation of the glory of God in the events that were about to be unfolded. I think the meaning is apparent. When the work of building the spiritual temple, which is the New Testament order, including the church, when this was completed on earth, and it was completed with the fully revealed Word of God. I think that's the thing that's being taught in 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 13. When the New Testament order was completely revealed, and all the New Testament books were completely written, that the glory of God filled his heavenly temple. Now, if you'd like to read concerning the development of the New Testament, we have a booklet on that. We'd be glad for you to get it and to read it, as well as the commentary, and we believe that you will be able to see some things here. But with God's spiritual temple on earth completed, the wrath of God then is poured out upon the nation of Israel. Now it says that no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. The glory of God was demonstrated for 3.5 years during the Roman-Jewish war, you recall. And from the time that Jerusalem was compassed with armies in late 66 A.D., and the Christians of Jerusalem and the surrounding areas fled to Pella and the mountains of Perea, the gospel was not preached to the lost of those regions. You see, the Christians had withdrawn from there. And having withdrawn from there, they were not preaching the gospel there. And I think the idea here is that in that region, that the gospel was not preached, and man therefore could not enter into the temple. That is, the under the New Testament order. He couldn't enter into the church. And so consequently, no man could enter into the temple of God, which is the church, until these plagues were over. This period of non-entrance, I think, corresponds to the same period when the woman fled into the wilderness that we read about in chapter 12, verses 6 and 14. I believe there is also a corresponding idea that is found in Revelation chapter 22 and in verse 11. When he said, "He that is unjust, let him be unjust still, and he which is filthy, let him be filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him be righteous still. And he that is holy, let him be holy still." What is he saying here? He's saying here, let things ride as they are. Let them stay as they are. Let the unrighteous be unrighteous. Let the unjust be unjust. Let the filthy be filthy still. Let the holy remain holy. In other words, there's a holding that is put on this here. So I think what you have here in this passage is at the time that God was preparing to pour out his wrath upon the nation of Israel, there was a period of non-entrance into the church as far as that the land of Palestine was concerned, at least, because the gospel which was in the hands of Christians was not there to be preached because they had withdrawn from the land and drawn to the place of their keeping in Perea. And for that reason, the gospel wasn't preached. I hope that would help to clarify the point that we were seeking to make relative to that passage. The next question we have regards Revelation 20 and verse 2, where it is said, "And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is called the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. The question that is raised is this the same binding that we see spoken about in Matthew 12 and 29 and John 12, 31 and other New Testament passages? Well, maybe it would be good for us to take a look at Matthew chapter 12. This is a particular case where Jesus was discussing the question of whether or not he cast out devils by the power of Beelzebub. And in the course of answering that question, he says in verse 25, "Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand. And if Satan cast out Satan, he is divided against himself. How shall then his kingdom stand? And if I by Beelzebub cast out devils, by whom do your children cast them out? Therefore they shall say they shall be your judges. But if I cast out devils by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God is come unto you. Or else, how can one enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods except he first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his goods?" Well, I think what the Lord is teaching in this passage is simply this. First of all, he is not casting out devils by the power of Beelzebub, because if he were casting them out by the power of Beelzebub, then Satan would be divided against himself and his kingdom couldn't stand. But what Jesus says that I am doing, I'm casting out devils, all right. If I cast out devils, then he says in verse 28, the Spirit of God is come unto you, or the kingdom of God is come unto you. If I'm doing this like I say I am, and that is by the Spirit of God, the Spirit of deity that is within me, by the very power of God himself, then you need to recognize the fact that the kingdom of God has come. But what was Jesus doing? He was casting out devils. With whom was Jesus' conflict? His conflict was with the devil. This is the conflict that developed in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15. When God pronounced the curse upon the serpent, he said, "I'll put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. Thou shalt bruise he shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." And that was the conflict that developed there. It's over sin. It's a conflict between Christ and Satan. Now Jesus says that in order for me as the Christ to overcome Satan, I've got to enter into his stronghold. I've got to enter into his domain. In casting out devils, Jesus was, in essence, entering into the domain of the devil. And he was able to cast out these devils, and therefore, as a result, he was having a victory over them. In the 10th chapter of Luke, Jesus sent forth 70 disciples, and he empowered them that they might be able to cast out devils by his power. When they returned from their journey, in verse 17, having accomplished things that they were given the power to accomplish, they said, "Lord, even the devils are subject unto us through thy name." And Jesus responded by saying unto them, "I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven." What did he mean by that? He simply meant that he was being victorious. Satan was being overthrown. We have entered into his house, and he is being thrown down. We are conquering Satan. Now, this same view of Satan, well, one other passage before we get to that. Let's think in terms of John chapter 12 and verse 31, where Jesus makes the statement concerning the devil. He said, "Now is the judgment of this world come. Now shall the prince of the world be cast out." He'll be cast out. I think we have that picture in Revelation chapter 12. We talked about it in a previous study. In this case, you see the glorious woman make her appearance as their feet standing on the moon. And she has couched before her this great red dragon, and he's there to devour her child as soon as it's born. But he fails. And the man-child is caught up under the throne of God. And then afterward, we see war developing in heaven in verse 7. And there is war between Michael and his angels and between the devil and his angels. And Michael prevails, and Satan is cast out. And the reason Satan is cast out is because the Lord Christ has been accepted. The atonement has been offered for the sins of the world. And so man's sins have been atoned for. Satan then has been cast out. And I think that these passages that we refer to back there identify those. Now the question is, in Revelation 20 and 2, is this the binding that he's talking about? And the answer to that is no. That binding took place when Jesus ascended on high and God accepted his sacrifice. Satan was defeated. He was cast out, as it were, of his place of rule and dominion over the souls of men because of sin. God accepted the atonement. He forgave them their sins and made them acceptable with him. So Satan had to be cast out of that realm, and he was bound from entering back into that realm. But now in this particular passage, he tells us the reason for the binding. In verse 3, he says, "And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years be fulfilled." You see, the reason he's bound the 1,000 years is that he deceived the nations no more. Not that he was not permitted to deceive men anymore, but that he would not be permitted to deceive the nations as he had deceived the Roman Empire and the nations that served the empire and the false religions of the empire, the false prophets. You see, they have just been destroyed in chapter 19. Now, immediately following upon their destruction, being cast into the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, Satan is bound. But he's bound that his power might be restricted. Not that he has no deceiving power at all, but that he should not deceive the nations as he had deceived Rome. This is the sense in which he is bound. And that is further borne out in verse 7 of this same chapter, when it says, "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth." In other words, he will be permitted now to do what he was restrained from doing previously. So, at the end of time, at some time, maybe already in existence, Satan would be permitted to go forth and develop another system much like the Roman Empire, maybe even more vast than that, and bring them together in a mighty war in which the saints of God would be attacked. And so it appears to me that the binding of Satan in this passage has to be restricted to the binding that he deceived the nations no more. In this same chapter also, and in verse 5, we've been asked to give some attention to verse 5, where it says, "But the rest of the dead live not again until the 1,000 years were finished." This is the first resurrection. Evidently, it was thought that maybe we had not made ourselves as abundantly clear on that particular point as we needed to. Let me suggest to you again what we had said previously here, that we have a picture here of the Hadean realm, and that the ones who are under consideration here are those who are in Hades. In verse 4, we have seen the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads, nor in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Now, in our discussion of this, we pointed out that what we have here is a picture of the realm of the dead. And we compared that to the picture that is seen by presented by Jesus in Luke, the 16th chapter. In that chapter, we have the picture of the rich man who had died. And after he had died, he lifted up his eyes in hell. And, of course, that just simply means in Hades. He lifted up his eyes, and he was in torment. He was tormented in the flames that were there. So there was some way in which there were some flames that was tormenting him there. On the other hand, in that particular scene, there was on the other side of a great gulf, Abraham's bosom. And in Abraham's bosom was Lazarus. Was Lazarus over there, and he was comforted. Now, this is the Old Testament scene, Old Testament view that is pictured here. This was before the redemption of Jesus Christ, the offering of his sacrifice for the sins of the world. And this man here is pictured as on the Old Testament scenes. And that's easily seen, because if you go back, the rich man asked Abraham that Lazarus be sent back to earth, that he might speak to his five brethren, so that they not come to that place. And Abraham said, well, they got the law and the prophets, let them hear them. So you see, he's back under the law and the prophets. Well, now what we have here in this scene is the dead saints under the law of Christ. Many of them have been martyred for their fidelity to the Lord. And as a result, they had lost their lives. And here they are presented as living and reigning with Christ. Well, let's just in some way get us a picture here as best we can. Let's say that here is the realm of God in heaven, and you have Christ here as well. And this is the realm of glorious light. And this is, in essence, in the very presence of God himself. The Apostle Paul made the observation that for him to depart and to be with the Lord is far greater. So I believe the Bible teaches that when we die in this present age, that we die and are in the presence of the Lord here. Of course, we're still in the Hadean realm, but we're in the presence of the Lord in this particular way. Now the question is concerning verse 5. In this particular passage, in verse 4, he mentions these dead saints, and we'll put the saints right here, who were living and reigning with Christ. They're living and reigning with Christ 1,000 years. They are a part of this system here, the place where they've been dead. They've been sanctified and cleansed already with the blood of Christ. Now then, this appears to me to be the thing that he says is the first resurrection. It's the first resurrection because of the fact that they have died on earth, and having gone through death, they have awakened, as it were, resurrected, or been resurrected as a soul here in paradise with the assurance that they will be saved eternally. Now in verse 5, he says, the rest of the dead. Here's the rest of the dead over you, the wicked. These are the ones who are the rest of the dead. These over here are not dead because they're living, but the rest of the dead. They live not again until the 1,000 years are finished. Now, we need to understand what death is. Death is a separation. Physical death is when the spirit separates from the body. Spiritual death is when man is separated from God. And I think that the point here is that when these men died physically and found themselves in this position here, being in torment in the Hadean realm, that they were separated from God, never to be in his presence again, at least at this particular time, that they are in a state of death. They do not have a resurrection unto comfort and glory and the presence of God at all. That they are separated from all of that. Now, he says, they live not again until the 1,000 years are over. That is, that long period of time when it's over. When that long period of time is over, they're going to be resurrected again, all right. But what are they resurrected for? They are resurrected for the judgment. You remember that Jesus makes the statement in John chapter 5 and verse 28, marvel not at this, for all that are in their graves shall hear his voice. They that have done good to the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil in the resurrection of damnation. You see, they're resurrected from death, but they're going to be appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Romans 14 and verse 10, we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Whether we be right or wrong, whether we be dead or alive, whether we be saved or lost, we'll be before the judgment seat of Christ. Now, when these individuals then are resurrected from the dead and brought from the Hadean realm of torment, which is a state of death, they will be once again brought before God, be in His presence. It could be said then in that sense that they are alive for a short while. But then after they have been before the judgment seat of God, if their names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life, and they won't be, then they're going to be cast in the lake of fire and brimstone, which he says is the second death. So that they will be consigned to eternal torment, to hellfire, for eternity. They were in this state of death as wicked individuals, and they lived not again until the time was over, the 1,000 years was over. They appeared before the judgment bar of God, sentence was passed, and then they became a part of the second death, from whence they cannot be resurrected. And so we hope that would give some clarification as to the meaning of that. It appears to me that the statement, this is the first resurrection, refers back to verse 4, where he talks about those dead saints who were living and reigning. They had been resurrected to life. But in verse 5, he's talking about the rest of the dead, and those who were not resurrected to life, that they would not live again until after the 1,000 years were finished, at which time they would be given release from the Hadean realm to appear before the judgment bar of God. Now, we hope that will be helpful in clarifying that. Then there is one other question that we have, and perhaps this is a deep-seated question. Many of those who write in relationship to the book of Revelation and an interpretation of it place a lot of stock in the comparison between the book of Daniel. In fact, when you read my commentary, you'll find that I place a great deal of stock in that as well. But in their studies of the book of Daniel, they have concluded that the book of Revelation and Daniel 7 are very closely related. And I agree, they are very closely related. In fact, in studying with a person just recently, he brought up this question and indicated that he thought, at least, that I did not agree with that philosophy. And after he had asserted his opinion that the 7th chapter of the book of Daniel was very important in understanding the book of Revelation, I readily agreed with him. But I put this rider on it. I said, if you understand what Daniel 7 is talking about, then you'll understand what the book of Revelation is talking about if you properly interpret both of them. But if you misunderstand Daniel 7, and you then try to interpret the book of Revelation in light of Daniel 7, then you will misunderstand the book of Revelation. So I want to take just a few moments, because we've been asked to do this, in order to try to understand what Daniel 7 is about. Now, we haven't been studying the book, and it would be actually out of place for us to have anything to say about Daniel 7 without knowing what's in the book. So if you will, listen carefully as we read that portion of Daniel 7, which may be all of it, before we give some explanation of what the passage is about. We begin with verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. And he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, And behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diversed from another, one diverse from another. The first beast was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet of as a man. And a man's heart was given to it. And I beheld another beast, a second like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly. It had a great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hairs of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from him, Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. And concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man come with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days. And they besought, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and the kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by, and asked him the truth of all of this. So he told me, and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, and even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured to break in pieces and stamped the residue with his feet. And of the 10 horns which were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom the three fell, even of that horn that had eyes, and his mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change the times and the laws. And they shall be given into his hands until the time and times and the dividing of the times. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and to devour it unto the end. The kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cognitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Well, as you can see, that's a very involved passage. He sees four different sets of beasts, and they are described in verse 17. He says, these great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. Those four kings represent the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire, and finally, the Roman Empire. Now, I must suggest to you that there are those who identify the fourth beast not as the Roman Empire at all, but as the empire of the Syrians and the empire of Antiochus Epiphanes. And he, of course, as far as they are concerned, is the development of that one great little horn that is pictured here. But our attention, of course, is more upon the fourth beast. And what he sees here is a beast that has 10 horns. And then he sees another little horn coming up, and in so doing, he uproots 3. But when it's all done, this is the chief horn. The question is, what is being seen here? We have to understand, I think, that the development of the Roman Empire, and I believe that's what it's talking about in this passage, is the development of the Roman Empire, that it wasn't born an empire. The fact is, it first of all was a monarchy. And then they fell out with the monarchs. And then they went to what was known as the Republic. Along about 509 B.C., the Roman Republic was founded. And for nearly 500 years, this republic was in existence. And it was under the spread of the republic that most of the land masses that were conquered by the Romans took place. But then along came a change in the way that people thought. And there came some mighty men among the Romans who were desirous of rule. One of those who was so desirous of rule that he did much to change all of it. In fact, he is sometimes called the father of the empire. His name was Julius Caesar. Julius was a brilliant man. And he sought every opportunity to advance himself in power in the government. He was not able, however, on his own to just take over. There were others who stood in the way. In order to progress his desires, he made a coalition with two other men. I believe the names of them were Pompey and Crassus. And that these three men became known as rulers of Rome. In fact, I read one book that called them the three-headed monster. But anyway, they took over the power of Rome in reality. Before then, it was ruled primarily by the Senate. But these took over. Crassus died. Julius Caesar conquered Pompey, fought against him in civil war and conquered him, which left only Julius Caesar. So in 48 B.C., Julius Caesar was recognized as the individual who was in chief power among the Romans. It lasted 4 years. But the members of the Senate never accepted it. They didn't like it. And so finally, in 44 B.C., Julius Caesar was summoned to the Senate floor, and they attacked him and killed him. After this, the government returned back to the Republican form of government. And after a brief period of time, there was the setting up of what was known as the Second Triumvirate. The first three men rule, which from whence Julius emerged, was known as the First Triumvirate. And the Second Triumvirate was made up of Octavius, who later was Augustus, and Mark Antony, and of a fellow by the name of Lepidus. These three together constituted what was known as the Second Triumvirate. Now, after a short while, a total of altogether 13 years, Octavius came out of that number one, and he established the throne of the empire, accepting the title and the crown. He began to rule. Now, here's what you see in John's vision. He sees the beast with 12 horns. He sees another beast come to power who uproots three, the triumvirate. And the uprooting of the three, we have the establishment of the one horn. And you may say, well, are you saying that was Julius Caesar? Yes and no. I'm saying that that was the beginning and the development of the emperorship. That what we see here is the change from the Roman Republic to the empire. Now, what is seen in this chapter is that this little horn is developed. And this little horn is going to make war with the saints. In fact, in verse 21, he says, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. But you'll notice that in these cases, where he makes war with the saints, his introduction in making war with the saints is prior to the Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days. And I want to emphasize that. You see, in this we have three different accounts. We have the first account given. We have Daniel's inquiries concerning the accounts on two different occasions. And once we get this, we set up a pattern. And we see that the little horn is developed before the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days. And before they are brought before him, before he's given dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all people and nations and languages serve him. Of course, that's Jesus Christ coming to the throne of God and beginning on Pentecost. But what we have in the picture is the little horn making his appearance before that. Now, what we have seen in recent years is that people have gone to this passage of Scripture, and they have decided in their minds that that little horn is Domitian. That he is the one that is under consideration here, and that he began the war against the saints and the persecution of the saints. There's just one thing wrong with that. Just one thing wrong with it. It isn't so. The reason is that it isn't so is that there is absolutely no evidence, no historical evidence, that Domitian was the persecutor he's been made out to be. And when that's considered, that whole theory goes down the drain. But the truth of the matter is that it represents the emperorship, and that the emperorship is pictured by that of Caesar himself from beginning until its end. And these make war with the saints. The saints here, I do not believe, are New Testament saints at all. Now, it may be that in a lingering sense they are. But in its beginning, when it begins before the Ancient of Days, or rather the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days, then the saints that here are being persecuted are not New Testament saints, but rather the holy people. The word saint simply means set apart, God's set apart people, those who are the nation of Israel. I think that if you look into chapter 8, that you will find that the word holy people that is used in verse 24 is from the family of words that is translated saint back in chapter 7. And the holy people in chapter 8 and verse 24, by all accounts, is the nation of Israel. The holy people there identify that nation. And so it is against the nation of Israel that the war is made by the little horn. Now, the question is raised about these who come and take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. Well, I think that's seen in the fact that when the Son of Man comes in the Ancient of Days, he's given a kingdom. Now the saints come and possess the kingdom. What saints? Well, there are saints that have been dead under the Old Testament order, but they're not in the kingdom yet. Then there are saints that come into being after the kingdom has its beginning and after it's been given unto the Son of Man. These come and take the kingdom? Yes. And possess it? Yes. That is, they are made part of it. The Old Testament saints who died before the death of Jesus Christ on the cross, when they are sanctified by his blood, become a part of his kingdom. And then those from that time forward who through faith and obedience to the gospel of Christ reign on the earth also become a part of that same kingdom. This is the kingdom that was established. This is the kingdom that the saints took. This is the kingdom that they possessed. And they possessed it in the sense that they then were admitted to its citizenship and were admitted to its family. So I think that gives you a picture of it. Now, how does that harmonize the book of Revelation? Well, I think it harmonizes with it perfectly, because that's precisely the case you see. You see in the book of Revelation the development of the Roman Empire. It's there for what purpose? It's there to settle the question, settle God's wrath upon the nation of Israel. In this picture, we have that scene too. If you'll notice that the saints are those that he's made war against. He even wears out the saints of the Most High, that is, this peculiar people. And when it's all over, he has poured out his wrath upon this people. And it says then, verse 25, and he shall speak against great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change the times and the laws, and they shall be given into his hands until a time and times of the dividing of the times. That's the same language you have in Revelation, identifying 3.5 years. That was the length of the war. 3.5 years of the Roman-Jewish war. Daniel is talking about the very same thing. So, if you understand Daniel 7, and you understand the book of Revelation, you're going to see that they are tied together perfectly. But if you misinterpret either one of them and try then to understand the other in the light of the misinterpretation, you're going to misinterpret and misunderstand both of them. Now, I hope that that will help to clarify some things and open up some doors of study for you, and that you'll be able to see more thoroughly how that there is a relationship between the two. Now, there may be some other questions that come to your mind. I would like to make this suggestion for you. First of all, be sure to purchase the commentary, The Avenging of the Apostles and Prophets. You can do that by writing in care of Ogden Publications, 10412 Starlight Way, Louisville, Kentucky, 40272. You can do it that way, read it, and see what else we've had to say about it, because in this tape, we have not been able to get into the detail of everything. We've not been able to cite the passages. We've not been able to read the passages. That would have taken 4 times as many hours as we've had in this study. But we've been able to give you a general picture of how the book of Revelation can be understood in the context of the desolation of the nation of Israel and the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. We believe, as you study further and you study more deeply, that you will find that this is the truth about the book of Revelation. I believe that as you study and try to put the pieces together, as you study the commentary that we have written, The Avenging of the Apostles and Prophets, that you'll see that the passages that are used, for the most part at least, are correctly used. I'm not going to lay claim to the fact that we have used scriptures 100% perfectly. We all make mistakes there. But I do want you to consider what's being said and to investigate it carefully. If we've misused a passage, well, we'll feel free to call that to our attention. And we believe that we're using them correctly, but if not, then that will be exposed, and we'll be glad to retract those. At the same time, there's one other thing we'd like to suggest for you, and that is that if you have question about what we have presented here, then you may be able to write us in care of the address that has been given you, and as time permits, we'll do our best to give you an explanation from the Word of God as to why we have said what we have said and taken the position that we have taken. But I appreciate so much that you're taking of your time to listen to these tapes and to study with us the book of Revelation in this way. I promised you in the very beginning that it would be one of the most thrilling experiences of your life. If you put your heart and mind to it, I'm sure that that has been true. I believe it will continue to be true as you continue to study God's Word as it relates to this glorious book. So I hope you will continue to study it, and that you will study it to find out the truth of God's Word. Keep studying, and may God bless you in the study which you do.